also asked its panelists to predict the outcome of 11 individual elections, a mix of Senate, House, and gubernatorial races. Here, the differences were much greater. The panel split on the winners they expected in the Senate races in Nevada, Illinois, and Pennsylvania, the governor's race in Florida, and a key House race in Iowa. Overall, Republican panelists expected Democrats to win just one of the 11 races, while Democratic panelists expected them to win 6 of the 11. The actual outcome, predictably enough, was somewhere in the middle. Democrats won 3 of the 11 races that National Journal had asked about. Obviously, partisanship plays some role here. Democrats and Republicans were each rooting for the home team. That does not suffice to explain, however, the unusual divide in the way that the panel answered the different types of questions. When asked in general terms about how well Republicans were likely to do, there was almost no difference between the panelists. They differed profoundly, however, when asked about specific cases. These brought the partisan differences to the surface. Too much information can be a bad thing in the hands of a hedgehog. The question of how many seats Republicans were likely to gain on Democrats overall is an abstract one. Unless you'd studied all 435 races, there was little additional detail that could help you to resolve it. By contrast, when asked about any one particular race, say the Senate race in Nevada, the panelists had all kinds of information at their disposal. Not just the polls there, but also news accounts they'd read about the race, gossip they'd heard from their friends, or what they thought about the candidates when they saw them on television. They might even know the candidates or the people who work for them personally. Hedgehogs who have lots of information construct stories. Stories that are neater and tidier than the real world, with protagonists and villains, winners and losers, climaxes and denouements, and usually a happy ending for the home team. The candidate who is down 10 points in the polls is going to win, goddammit, because I know the candidate, and I know the voters in her state, and maybe I heard something from her press secretary about how the polls are tightening. And have you seen her latest commercial? When we construct these stories, we can lose the ability to think about the evidence critically. Elections typically present compelling narratives. Whatever you thought about the politics of Barack Obama or Sarah Palin or John McCain or Hillary Clinton in 2008, they had persuasive life stories. Reported books on the 2008 campaign like Game Change read like novels. The candidates who ran in 2012 were a less appealing lot, but still more than sufficed to provide for the usual ensemble of dramatic cliches from tragedy, Herman Cain, to farce, Rick Perry. You can get lost in the narrative. Politics may be especially susceptible to poor predictions precisely because of its human elements. A good election engages our dramatic sensibilities. This does not mean that you must feel totally dispassionate about a political event in order to make a good prediction about it, but it does mean that a fox's aloof attitude can pay dividends. A fox-like approach to forecasting. I had the idea for 538, while waiting out a delayed flight at Louis Armstrong New Orleans International Airport in February 2008. For some reason, possibly the Cajun Martinis had stirred something up, it suddenly seemed obvious that someone needed to build a website that predicted how well Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, then still in heated contention for the Democratic nomination, would fare against John McCain. My interest in electoral politics had begun slightly earlier, however, and had been mostly the result of frustration rather than any affection for the political process. I had carefully monitored the Congress's attempt to ban internet poker in 2006, which was then one of my main sources of income. I found political coverage wanting, even as compared with something like sports, where the Moneyball revolution had significantly improved analysis. During the run-up to the primary, I found myself watching more and more political TV, mostly MSNBC and CNN and Fox News. A lot of the coverage was vapid. Despite the election being many months away, commentary focused on the inevitability of Clinton's nomination, ignoring the uncertainty intrinsic to such early polls. There seemed to be too much focus on Clinton's gender and Obama's race. There was an obsession with determining which candidate had won the day by making some clever quip at a press conference or getting some no-name senator to endorse them. Things that 99% of voters did not care about. Political news, and especially the important news that really affects the campaign, proceeds at an irregular pace. But news coverage is produced every day. Most of it is filler, packaged in the form of stories that are designed to obscure its unimportance. Not only does political coverage often lose the signal, it frequently accentuates the noise. If there are a number of polls in a state that show the Republican ahead, it won't make news when another one says the same thing. But if a new poll comes out showing the Democrat with the lead, it will grab headlines, even though the poll is probably an outlier and won't predict the outcome accurately. The bar set by the competition, in other words, was invitingly low. Someone could look like a genius simply by doing some fairly basic research into what really has predictive power in a political campaign. So I began blogging at the website Daily Kos, posting detailed and data-driven analyses on issues like polls and fundraising numbers. I studied which polling firms had been most accurate in the past, and how much winning one state, Iowa for instance, tended to shift the numbers in another. The articles quickly gained a following, even though the commentary at sites like Daily Kos is usually more qualitative and partisan than quantitative. In March 2008, I spun my analysis out to my own website, 538, which sought to make predictions about the general election. The 538 forecasting model started out pretty simple. Basically, it took an average of polls, but weighted them according to their past accuracy. Then gradually became more intricate. But it abided by three broad principles, all of which are very Fox-like. Principle 1. Think probabilistically. Almost all the forecasts that I publish, in politics and other fields, are probabilistic. Instead of spitting out just one number and claiming to know exactly what will happen, I instead articulate a range of possible outcomes. On November 2, 2010, for instance, I forecasted how many seats Republicans might gain in the U.S. House. The most likely range of outcomes, enough to cover about half of all possible cases, was a Republican gain between 45 and 65 seats. Their actual gain was 63 seats. But there was also the possibility that Republicans might win 70 or 80 seats, if almost certainly not the 100 seats that Dick Morris had predicted. Conversely, there was also the chance that Democrats would hold just enough seats to keep the House. The wide distribution of outcomes represented the most honest expression of the uncertainty in the real world. The forecast was built from forecasts of each of the 435 House seats individually, and an exceptionally large number of those races looked to be extremely close. As it happened, a remarkable 77 seats were decided by a single-digit margin. Had the Democrats beaten their forecasts by just a couple of points in most of the competitive districts, they could easily have retained the House. Had the Republicans done the opposite, they could have run their gains into truly astonishing numbers. A small change in the political tides could have produced a dramatically different result. It would have been foolish to pin things down to an exact number. This probabilistic principle also holds when I am forecasting the outcome in an individual race. How likely is a candidate to win, for instance, if he's ahead by 5 points in the polls? This is the sort of question that 538's models are trying to address. The answer depends significantly on the type of race that he's involved in. The further down the ballot you go, the more volatile the polls tend to be. Polls of House races are less accurate than polls of Senate races, which are in turn less accurate than polls of presidential races. Polls of primaries also are considerably less accurate than general election polls. During the 2008 Democratic primaries, the average poll missed by about 8 points, far more than implied by its margin of error. The problems in polls of the Republican primaries of 2012 may have been even worse. In many of the major states, in fact, including Iowa, South Carolina, Florida, Michigan, Washington, Colorado, Ohio, Alabama, and Mississippi, the candidate ahead in the polls a week before the election lost. But polls do become more accurate the closer you get to Election Day. A 538 Senate forecasting model uses data from 1998 through 2008 to infer the probability that a candidate will win on the basis of the size of his lead in the polling average. A Senate candidate with a 5-point lead on the day before the election, for instance, has historically won his race about 95% of the time. Almost a sure thing, even though news accounts are sure to describe the race as too close to call. By contrast, a 5-point lead a year before the election translates to just a 59% chance of winning, barely better than a coin flip. The 538 models provide much of their value in this way. It's very easy to look at an election, see that one candidate is ahead in all or most of the polls, and determine that he's the favorite to win. With some exceptions, this assumption will be correct. What becomes much trickier is determining exactly how much of a favorite he is. Our brains, wired to detect patterns, are always looking for a signal, when instead we should appreciate how noisy the data is. I've grown accustomed to this type of thinking, because my background consists of experience in two disciplines, sports and poker, in which you'll see pretty much everything at least once. Play enough poker hands and you'll make your share of royal flushes. Play a few more, and you'll find that your opponent has made a royal flush when you have a full house. Sports, especially baseball, also provide for plenty of opportunity for low-probability events to occur. The Boston Red Sox failed to make the playoffs in 2011, despite having a 99.7% chance of doing so at one point, although I wouldn't question anyone who says the normal laws of probability don't apply when it comes to the Red Sox or the Chicago Cubs. Politicians and political observers, however, find this lack of clarity upsetting. In 2010, a Democratic congressman called me a few weeks in advance of the election. He represented a safely Democratic district on the West Coast. But given how well Republicans were doing that year, he was nevertheless concerned about losing his seat. What he wanted to know was exactly how much uncertainty there was in our forecast. Our numbers gave him, to the nearest approximation, a 100% chance of winning. But did 100% really mean 99%, or 99.99%, or 99.9999%? If the latter, a 1 in 100,000 chance of losing, he was prepared to donate his campaign funds to other candidates in more vulnerable districts. But he wasn't willing to take a 1 in 100 risk. Political partisans, meanwhile, may misinterpret the role of uncertainty in a forecast. They will think of it as hedging your bets and building in an excuse for yourself in case you get the prediction wrong. That is not really the idea. If you forecast that a particular incumbent congressman will win his race 90% of the time, you're also forecasting that he should lose it 10% of the time. The signature of a good forecast is that each of these probabilities turns out to be right over the long run. Tetlock's hedgehogs were especially bad at understanding these probabilities. When you say that an event has a 90% chance of happening, that has a very specific and objective meaning. But our brains translate it into something more subjective. Evidence from the psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky suggests that these subjective estimates don't always match up with the reality. We have trouble distinguishing a 90% chance that the plane will land safely from a 99% chance or a 99.9999% chance, even though these imply vastly different things about whether we ought to book our ticket. With practice, our estimates can get better. What distinguished Tetlock's hedgehogs is that they were too stubborn to learn from their mistakes. Acknowledging the real-world uncertainty in their forecasts would require them to acknowledge to the imperfections in their theories about how the world was supposed to behave. The last thing that an ideologue wants to do. Principle 2. Today's forecast is the first forecast of the rest of your life. Another misconception is that a good prediction shouldn't change. Certainly, if there are wild gyrations in your forecast from day to day, that may be a bad sign, either of a badly designed model or that the phenomenon you are attempting to predict isn't very predictable at all. In 2012, when I published forecasts of the Republican primaries in advance of each state, solely according to the polls there, the probabilities often shifted substantially, just as the polls did. When the outcome is more predictable, as a general election is in the late stages of the race, the forecasts will normally be more stable. The comment that I heard most frequently from Democrats after the 2008 election was that they turned to 538 to help keep them calm. By the end of a presidential race, as many as 30 or 40 polls might be released every day from different states, and some of these results will inevitably fall outside the margin of error. Candidates, strategists, and television commentators who have some vested interest in making the race seem closer than it really is might focus on these outlier polls, but the 538 model found that they usually didn't make much difference. Ultimately, the right attitude is that you should make the best forecast possible today, regardless of what you said last week, last month, or last year. Making a new forecast does not mean that the old forecast just disappears. Ideally, you should keep a record of it and let people evaluate how well you did over the whole course of predicting an event. But if you have reason to think that yesterday's forecast was wrong, there is no glory in sticking to it. When the facts change, I change my mind, the economist John Maynard Keynes famously said. What do you do, sir? Some people don't like this type of course-correcting analysis and mistake it for a sign of weakness. It seems like cheating to change your mind, the equivalent of sticking your finger out and seeing which way the wind is blowing. The critiques usually rely, implicitly or explicitly, on the notion that politics is analogous to something like physics or biology, abiding by fundamental laws that are intrinsically knowable and predictable. One of my most frequent critics is a professor of neuroscience at Princeton. Under those circumstances, new information doesn't matter very much. Elections should follow a predictable orbit, like a comet hurtling toward Earth. Instead of physics or biology, however, electoral forecasting resembles something like poker. We can observe our opponent's behavior and pick up a few clues, but we can't see his cards. Making the most of that limited information requires a willingness to update one's forecast as newer and better information becomes available. It is the alternative, failing to change our forecast because we risk embarrassment by doing so, that reveals a lack of courage. Principle 3. Look for consensus. Every hedgehog fantasizes that they will make a daring, audacious, outside-the-box prediction, one that differs radically from the consensus view on a subject. Their colleagues ostracize them. Even their golden retrievers start to look at them a bit funny. But then the prediction turns out to be exactly, profoundly, indubitably right. 2 days later, they are on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and sitting on Jay Leno's couch, singled out as a bold and brave pioneer. Every now and then, it might be correct to make a forecast like this. The expert consensus can be wrong. Someone who had forecasted the collapse of the Soviet Union would have deserved most of the kudos that came to him. But the fantasy scenario is hugely unlikely. Even though foxes, myself included, aren't really a conformist lot, we get worried any time our forecasts differ radically from those being produced by our competitors. Quite a lot of evidence suggests that aggregate or group forecasts are more accurate than individual ones, often somewhere between 15 and 20% more accurate, depending on the discipline. That doesn't necessarily mean the group forecasts are good. We'll explore this subject in more depth later in the book. But it does mean that you can benefit from applying multiple perspectives toward a problem. Foxes often manage to do inside their heads what you'd do with a whole group of hedgehogs, Tetlock told me. What he means is that foxes have developed an ability to emulate this consensus process. Instead of asking questions of a whole group of experts, they are constantly asking questions of themselves. Often, this implies that they will aggregate different types of information together, as a group of people with different ideas about the world naturally would, instead of treating any one piece of evidence as though it is the Holy Grail. 538's forecasts, for instance, typically combine polling data with information about the economy, the demographics of a state, and so forth. Forecasters who have failed to heed Tetlock's guidance have often paid the price for it. Beware magic bullet forecasts. In advance of the 2000 election, the economist Douglas Hibbs published a forecasting model that claimed to produce remarkably accurate predictions about how presidential elections would turn out based on just two variables, one related to economic growth and the other to the number of military causalities. Hibbs made some very audacious and hedgehoggish claims. He said accounting for a president's approval rating, historically a very reliable indicator of his likelihood to be reelected, would not improve his forecasts at all. Nor did the inflation rate or the unemployment rate matter. And the identity of the candidates made no difference. A party may as well nominate a highly ideological senator like George McGovern, or a centrist and war hero like Dwight D. Eisenhower. The key instead, Hibbs asserted, was a relatively obscure economic variable called real disposable income per capita. So how did the model do? It forecasted a landslide victory for Al Gore, predicting him to win the election by 9 percentage points. But George W. Bush won instead after the recount in Florida. Gore did win the nationwide popular vote, but the model had implied that the election would be nowhere near close, attributing only about a 1 in 80 chance to such a tight finish. There were several other models that took a similar approach, claiming they had boiled down something as complex as a presidential election to a two-variable formula. Strangely, none of them used the same two variables. Some of them, in fact, have a far worse track record than Hibbs's approach. In 2000, one of these models projected a 19-point victory for Gore and would have given billions to one odds against the actual outcome. These models had come into vogue after the 1988 election, in which the fundamentals seemed to favor George H.W. Bush. The economy was good and Bush's Republican predecessor Reagan was popular. But the polls had favored Michael Dukakis until late in the race. Bush wound up winning easily. Since these models came to be more widely published, however, their track record has been quite poor. On average, in the 5 presidential elections since 1992, the typical fundamentals-based model, one that ignored the polls and claimed to discern exactly how voters would behave without them, has missed the final margin between the major candidates by almost 7 percentage points. Models that take a more Fox-like approach, combining economic data with polling data and other types of information, have produced more reliable results. Weighing qualitative information. The failure of these magic bullet forecasting models came even though they were quantitative, relying on published economic statistics. In fact, some of the very worst forecasts that I document in this book are quantitative. The ratings agencies, for instance, had models that came to precise, data-driven estimates of how likely different types of mortgages were to default. These models were dangerously wrong because they relied on a self-serving assumption that the default risk for different mortgages had little to do with one another. That made no sense in the midst of a housing and credit bubble. To be certain, I have a strong preference for more quantitative approaches in my own forecasts. But hedgehogs can take any type of information and have it reinforce their biases, while foxes who have practice in weighing different types of information together can sometimes benefit from accounting for qualitative along with quantitative factors. Few political analysts have a longer track record of success than the tight-knit team that runs the Cook Political Report. The group, founded in 1984 by a genial, round-faced Louisianan named Charlie Cook, is relatively little known outside the Beltway. But political junkies have relied on Cook's forecasts for years and have rarely had reason to be disappointed with their results. Cook and his team have one specific mission: to predict the outcome of U.S. elections particularly to the Congress. This means issuing forecasts for all 435 races for the U.S. House, as well as the 35 or so races for the U.S. Senate that take place every other year. Predicting the outcome of Senate or gubernatorial races is relatively easy. The candidates are generally well known to voters, and the most important races attract widespread attention and are polled routinely by reputable firms. Under these circumstances, it is hard to improve on a good method for aggregating polls, like the one I use at 538. House races are another matter, however. The candidates often rise from relative obscurity. City councilmen are small business owners who decide to take their shot at national politics, and in some cases are barely known to voters until just days before the election. Congressional districts, meanwhile, are spread throughout literally every corner of the country, giving rise to any number of demographic idiosyncrasies. The polling in House districts tends to be erratic at best, when it is available at all, which it often isn't. But this does not mean there is no information available to analysts like Cook. Indeed, there is an abundance of it. In addition to polls, there is data on the demographics of the district and on how it has voted in past elections. There is data on overall partisan trends throughout the country, such as approval ratings for the incumbent president. There is data on fundraising, which must be scrupulously reported to the Federal Elections Commission. Other types of information are more qualitative, but are nonetheless potentially useful. Is the candidate a good public speaker? How in tune is her platform with the peculiarities of the district? What type of ads is she running? A political campaign is essentially a small business. How well does she manage people? Of course, all of that information could just get you into trouble if you were a hedgehog who wasn't weighing it carefully. But Cook Political has a lot of experience in making forecasts, and they have an impressive track record of accuracy. Cook Political classifies races along a 7-point scale, ranging from solid Republican, a race that the Republican candidate is almost certain to win, to solid Democrat, just the opposite. Between 1998 and 2010, the races that Cook described as solid Republican were in fact won by the Republican candidate on 1,205 out of 1,207 occasions, well over 99% of the time. Likewise, races that they described as solid Democrat were won by the Democrat in 1,226 out of 1,229 instances. Many of the races that Cook places into the solid Democrat or solid Republican categories occur in districts where the same party wins every year by landslide margins. These are not that hard to call. But Cook Political has done just about as well in races that require considerably more skill to forecast. Elections they've classified as merely leaning toward the Republican candidate, for instance, have in fact been won by the Republican about 95% of the time. Likewise, races they've characterized as leaning to the Democrat have been won by the Democrat 92% of the time. Furthermore, the Cook forecasts have a good track record even when they disagree with quantitative indicators like polls. I visited the Cook Political team in Washington one day in September 2010, about 5 weeks ahead of that November's elections, and spent the afternoon with David Wasserman, a curly-haired 30-something who manages their House forecasts. The most unique feature of Cook's process is their candidate interviews. At election time, the entryway to the fifth floor of the Watergate complex, where the Cook offices are located, becomes a literal revolving door, with candidates dropping by for hour-long chats in between fundraising and strategy sessions. Wasserman had 3 interviews scheduled on the day that I visited. He offered to let me sit in on one of them with a Republican candidate named Dan Capanke. Capanke was hoping to unseat the incumbent Democrat Ron Kind in Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district, which encompasses a number of small communities in the southwestern corner of the state. Cook Political had the race rated as likely Democrat, which means they assigned Capanke only a small chance of victory, but they were considering moving it into a more favorable category, lean Democrat. Capanke, a state senator who ran a farm supply business, had the gruff demeanor of a high school gym teacher. He also had a thick Wisconsin accent. When he spoke about the La Crosse Loggers, the minor league baseball team that he owns, I wasn't certain whether he was referring to lager as in timber cutter or lager as in beer, either one of which would have been an apropos nickname for a ball club from Wisconsin. At the same time, his plain-spokenness helped to overcome what he might have lacked in charm, and he had consistently won his state senate seat in a district that ordinarily voted Democratic. Wasserman, however, takes something of a poker player's approach to his interviews. He is stone-faced and unfailingly professional, but he is subtly seeking to put the candidate under some stress so that they might reveal more information to him. "My basic technique," he told me, "is to try to establish a comfortable and friendly rapport with a candidate early on in an interview, mostly by getting them to talk about the fuzzy details of where they are from. Then I try to ask more pointed questions. Name an issue where you disagree with your party's leadership. The goal isn't so much to get them to unravel as it is to get a feel for their style and approach." His interview with Kapanke followed this template. Wasserman's knowledge of the nooks and crannies of political geography can make him seem like a local, and Kapanke was happy to talk shop about the intricacies of his district, just how many voters he needed to win in La Crosse to make up for the ones he'd lose in Eau Claire. But he stumbled over a series of questions on allegations that he had used contributions from lobbyists to buy a new set of lights for the Loggers' ballpark. It was small bore stuff. It wasn't like Kapanke had been accused of cheating on his wife or his taxes. But it was enough to dissuade Wasserman from changing the rating. Indeed, Kapanke lost his election that November by about 9,500 votes, even though Republicans won their races throughout most of the similar districts in the Midwest. This is, in fact, the more common occurrence. Wasserman will usually maintain the same rating after the interview. As hard as he works to glean new information from the candidates, it is often not important enough to override his prior take on the race. Wasserman's approach works, because he is capable of evaluating this information without becoming dazzled by the candidate sitting in front of him. A lot of less capable analysts would open themselves to being charmed, lied to, spun, or would otherwise get hopelessly lost in the narrative of the campaign. Or they would fall in love with their own spin about the candidate's interview skills, neglecting all the other information that was pertinent to the race. Wasserman instead considers everything in the broader political context. A terrific Democratic candidate who aces her interview might not stand a chance in a district that the Republican normally wins by 20 points. So why bother with the candidate interviews at all? Mostly, Wasserman is looking for red flags, like the time when the Democratic Congressman Eric Massa, who would later abruptly resign from Congress after accusations that he sexually harassed a male staffer, kept asking Wasserman how old he was. The psychologist Paul Meehl called these broken leg cases, situations where there is something so glaring that it would be foolish not to account for it. Catching a few of these each year helps Wasserman to call a few extra races right. He is able to weigh the information from his interviews without overweighing it, which might actually make his forecasts worse. Whether information comes in a quantitative or qualitative flavor is not as important as how you use it. It isn't easy to be objective. In this book, I use the terms objective and subjective carefully. The word objective is sometimes taken to be synonymous with quantitative, but it isn't. Instead, it means seeing beyond our personal biases and prejudices and toward the truth of a problem. Pure objectivity is desirable but unattainable in this world. When we make a forecast, we have a choice from among many different methods. Some of these might rely solely on quantitative variables like polls, while approaches like Wasserman's may consider qualitative factors as well. All of them, however, introduce decisions and assumptions that have to be made by the forecaster. Wherever there is human judgment, there is the potential for bias. The way to become more objective is to recognize the influence that our assumptions play in our forecasts and to question ourselves about them. In politics, Between our ideological predispositions and our propensity to weave tidy narratives from noisy data, this can be especially difficult. So you will need to adopt some different habits from the pundits you see on TV. You will need to learn how to express and quantify the uncertainty in your predictions. You will need to update your forecast as facts and circumstances change. You will need to recognize that there is wisdom in seeing the world from a different viewpoint. The more you are willing to do these things, the more capable you will be of evaluating a wide variety of information without abusing it. In short, you will need to learn how to think like a fox. The foxy forecaster recognizes the limitations that human judgment imposes in predicting the world's course. Knowing those limits can help her to get a few more predictions right. Chapter 3. All I care about is W's and L's. The Red Sox were in a very bad mood. They had just returned from New York, where they had lost all three games of a weekend series to the hated Yankees, ending their chances to win the 2009 American League East title. With only 7 games left in the regular season, the Red Sox were almost certain to make the playoffs as the American League's wild card. But this was not how the organization wanted to go into the postseason. Statistical studies have shown that the way a team finishes the regular season has little bearing on how they perform in the playoffs. But the Red Sox were starting to sense that it was not their year. I was at Fenway Park to speak to one person, the Red Sox star second baseman Dustin Pedroia. Pedroia had been one of my favorite players since 2006, when Pecota, the projection system that I developed for the organization Baseball Prospectus, had predicted that he would become one of the best players in baseball. Pecota's prediction stood sharply in contrast to the position of many scouts, who dismissed Pedroia as not physically gifted, critiquing his short stature and his loopy swing, and concluding that he would be a marginal player. Whereas Pecota ranked Pedroia as the 4th best prospect in baseball in 2006, the publication Baseball America, which traditionally gives more emphasis to the views of scouts, put him at 77th. Instead, reports like this one, filed by ESPN's Keith Law early in Pedroia's rookie season, were typical. Dustin Pedroia doesn't have the strength or bat speed to hit major league pitching consistently, and he has no power. If he can continue to hit 260 or so, he'll be useful and probably has a future as a backup infielder if he can stop rolling over to third base and shortstop. Law published that comment on May 12, 2007, at which point Pedroia was hitting 247 and had just one home run. Truth be told, I was losing my faith too. I had watched most of his at-bats, and Pedroia looked overmatched at the plate. But almost as though he wanted to prove his doubters wrong, Pedroia started hitting the tar out of the baseball. Over the course of his next 15 games, he hit a remarkable .472, bringing his batting average, which had dropped to as low as .158 in April, all the way up to .336. In July, 2 months after Law's report, Pedroia made the American League All-Star team. In October, he helped the Red Sox win only their 2nd World Series since 1918. That November, he was named Rookie of the Year. The next season, at the age of 24, Pedroia took the Most Valuable Player Award as the American League's best all-around performer. He wasn't a backup infielder any longer, but a superstar. The scouts had seriously underestimated him. I'd come to Fenway because I wanted to understand what made Pedroia tick. I had prepared a whole list of questions, and the Red Sox had arranged a press credential for me and given me field-level access. It wasn't going to be easy, I knew. A major league playing field, which players regard as their sanctuary, is not the best place to conduct an interview. The Red Sox, coming off their losing weekend, were grumpy and tense. As I watched Pedroia take infield practice, grabbing throws from Kevin Youkilis, the team's hulking third baseman, and relaying them to his new first baseman, Casey Kochman, it was clear that there was something different about him. Pedroia's actions were precise, whereas Youkilis botched a few plays and Kochman's attention seemed to wander. But mostly there was his attitude. Pedroia whipped the ball around the infield, looking annoyed whenever he perceived a lack of concentration from his teammates. After about 15 minutes of practice, the Red Sox left the infield to the Toronto Blue Jays, their opponents that evening. Pedroia walked past me as I stood on the first base side of the infield, just a couple of yards from the Red Sox dugout. The scouts were right about his stature. Pedroia is officially listed at 5'9", my height if you're rounding up, but I had a good 2 inches on him. They're also right about his decidedly non-athletic appearance. Balding at age 25, Pedroia had as much hair on his chin as on his head, and a little paunch showed through his home whites. If you saw him on the street, you might take him for a video rental clerk. Pedroia turned to enter the dugout, where he sat all by himself. This seemed like the perfect moment to catch him, so I mustered up my courage. "Hey, Dustin, you got a minute?" Pedroia stared at me suspiciously for a couple of seconds, and then declared, in as condescending a manner as possible, every syllable spaced out for emphasis, "No, I don't. I'm trying to get ready for the big league baseball game." I hung around the field for a few minutes trying to recover my dignity before ambling up to the press box to watch the game. The next day, after my credential had expired and I'd headed back to New York, I sent my friend David Lorilla, a former colleague of mine at Baseball Prospectus and a veteran interviewer, on a reconnaissance mission to see if he could get something more useful out of Pedroia. But Pedroia wasn't much more talkative, giving Lorilla about the blandest quote imaginable. "You know what? I'm a guy who doesn't care about numbers and stats," he told Lorilla. "All I care about is W's and L's. I care about wins and losses. Nothing else matters to me." Pedroia had learned to speak in this kind of cliché after getting himself into all kinds of trouble when straying from the party line, like the time he called his hometown of Woodland, California, a dump. "You can quote me on that," Pedroia told Boston Magazine. "I don't give a shit." He doesn't give a shit. I would come to realize that without that attitude, Pedroia might have let the scouting reports go to his head and never have made the big leagues. Building a baseball forecasting system. I've been a fan of baseball and baseball statistics for as long as I can remember. My hometown team, the Detroit Tigers, won the World Series in 1984 when I was 6. As an annoying little math prodigy, I was attracted to all the numbers in the game, buying my first baseball card at 7, reading my first Elias baseball analyst at 10, and creating my own statistic at 12. It somewhat implausibly concluded that the obscure Red Sox infielder Tim Nehring was one of the best players in the game. My interest peaked, however, in 2002. At the time, Michael Lewis was busy writing Moneyball, the soon-to-be national bestseller that chronicled the rise of the Oakland Athletics and their statistically savvy general manager Billy Beane. Bill James, who 25 years earlier had ushered in the sabermetric era by publishing a book called The Bill James Baseball Abstract, was soon to be hired as a consultant by the Red Sox. An unhealthy obsession with baseball statistics suddenly seemed like it could be more than just a hobby. And as it happened, I was looking for a new job. 2 years out of college, I was living in Chicago and working as something called a transfer pricing consultant for the accounting firm KPMG. The job wasn't so bad. My bosses and coworkers were friendly and professional. The pay was honest and I felt secure. But telling a company how to set prices at its cell phone factory in Malaysia so as to minimize its tax exposure, or hopping a 6 a.m. flight to St. Louis to value contracts for a coal company, was not exactly my idea of stimulating work. It was all too riskless, too prudent, and too routine for a restless 24-year-old, and I was as bored as I'd ever been. The one advantage, however, was that I had a lot of extra time on my hands. So in my empty hours, I started building a colorful spreadsheet full of baseball statistics that would later become the basis for Pacoda. While in college, I had started reading an annual publication called Baseball Prospectus. The series was founded in 1996 by Gary Huckabee, an ebullient and sarcastic redhead who had recruited a team of writers from the early internet news group rec.sport.baseball, then at the vanguard of the statistical analysis of the sport. Huckabee had sensed a market opportunity. Bill James had stopped publishing his abstracts in 1988, and most of the products that endeavored to replace it were not as good, or had folded during the prolonged baseball strike of 1994 and 1995. The first baseball prospectus, published in 1996, was produced one copy at a time on a laser printer, accidentally omitted the St. Louis Cardinals chapter, and sold just 75 copies. But the book quickly developed a cult following, with sales increasing exponentially each year. Baseball Prospectus was a stat geek's wet dream. There were the reams and reams of numbers, not just for major league players, but also for minor league prospects whose performance had been translated to the major league level. The writing was sharp, if sometimes esoteric, full of Simpsons references, jokes about obscure 80s porn films, and sarcastic asides about the group's least favorite general managers. But most important were its predictions about how each player would perform in the next season, in the form of a Huckabee-developed projection system called Vladimir. The system seemed to be the next step in the revolution that James had begun. A good baseball projection system must accomplish three basic tasks. 1. Account for the context of a player's statistics. 2. Separate out skill from luck. 3. Understand how a player's performance evolves as he ages, what is known as the aging curve. The first task is relatively easy. Baseball, uniquely among the major American sports, has always been played on fields with non-standard dimensions. It's much easier to put up a high batting average in snug and boxy Fenway Park, whose contours are shaped by compact New England street grids, than in the cavernous environs of Dodger Stadium, which is surrounded by a mode of parking lot. By observing how players perform both at home and on the road, we can develop park factors to account for the degree of difficulty that a player faces. For example, Fred Lynn, an MVP with the Red Sox during the 1970s, hit .347 over the course of his career at Fenway Park, but just .264 at every other stadium. Likewise, by observing what happens to players who switch from the National League to the American League, we can tell quite a bit about which league is better and account for the strength of a player's competition. The world's richest data set. The second chore, separating skill from luck, requires more work. Baseball is designed in such a way that luck tends to predominate in the near term. Even the best teams lose about one-third of their ball games, and even the best hitters fail to get on base 3 out of every 5 times. Sometimes luck will obscure a player's real skill level even over the course of a whole year. During a given season, a true .275 hitter has about a 10% chance of hitting .300 and a 10% chance of hitting .250 on the basis of luck alone. What a well-designed forecasting system can do is sort out which statistics are relatively more susceptible to luck. Batting average, for instance, is more erratic than home runs. This is even more important for pitchers, whose statistics are notoriously inconsistent. If you want to predict a pitcher's win-loss record, looking at the number of strikeouts he recorded and the number of walks he yielded is more informative than looking at his W's and L's from the previous season, because the former statistics are much more consistent from year to year. The goal, as in formulating any prediction, is to weed out the root cause. Striking batters out prevents them from getting on base. Preventing them from getting on base prevents them from scoring runs. And preventing them from scoring runs prevents them from winning games. However, the further downstream you go, the more noise will be introduced into the system. A pitcher's win-loss record is affected as much by how many runs his offense scores, something that he has essentially no control over, as by how well he pitches. The Seattle Mariners star pitcher Felix Hernandez went 19-5 in 2009, but 13-12 in 2010, despite pitching roughly as well in both years, because the Mariners had some epically terrible hitters in 2010. Cases like these are not at all uncommon, and tend to make themselves known if you spend any real effort to sort through the data. Baseball offers perhaps the world's richest data set. Pretty much everything that has happened on a major league playing field in the past 140 years has been dutifully and accurately recorded, and hundreds of players play in the big leagues every year. Meanwhile, although baseball is a team sport, it proceeds in a highly orderly way. Pitchers take their turn in the rotation, hitters take their turn in the batting order, and they are largely responsible for their own statistics. There are relatively few problems involving complexity and non-linearity. The causality is easy to sort out. That makes life easy for a baseball forecaster. A hypothesis can usually be tested empirically and proven or disproven to a high degree of statistical satisfaction. In fields like economic or political forecasting, where the data is much sparser, one presidential election every 4 years, not hundreds of new data points every year, you won't have that luxury, and your prediction is more likely to go astray. Behold, the aging curve. All this assumes, however, that a player's skill level is consistent from year to year. If only we could separate the signal from the noise, we'd know everything that we needed to. In fact, a baseball player's skills are in a constant state of flux, and therein lies the challenge. By looking at statistics for thousands of players, James had discovered that the typical player continues to improve until he is in his late 20s, at which point his skills usually begin to atrophy, especially once he reaches his mid-30s. This gave James one of his most important inventions, the aging curve. Olympic gymnasts peak in their teens, poets in their 20s, chess players in their 30s, applied economists in their 40s, and the average age of a Fortune 500 CEO is 55. A baseball player, James found, peaks at age 27. Of the 50 MVP winners between 1985 and 2009, 60% were between the ages of 25 and 29, and 20% were aged 27 exactly. This is when the combination of physical attributes and mental attributes needed to play the game well seemed to be in the best balance. This notion of the aging curve would have been extremely valuable to any team that had read James's work. Under baseball's contract rules, players do not become free agents until fairly late in their careers, after they've played at least 6 full major league seasons. Before then, they are under the exclusive control of the club that drafted them and cannot command a full market price. Since the typical rookie reaches the big leagues at 23 or 24 years old, he might not become a free agent until he is 30, just after his window of peak performance has eclipsed. Teams were paying premium dollars for free agents on the assumption that they would replicate in their 30s the production they had exhibited in their 20s. In fact, they usually declined, and since Major League Baseball contracts are guaranteed, the teams had no recourse. But James's aging curve painted too smooth a picture. Sure, the average player might peak at age 27. As anyone who has paid his dues staring at the backs of baseball cards can tell you, however, players age at different paces. Bob Horner, a third baseman with the Atlanta Braves during the 1980s, won the Rookie of the Year award when he was just 20, and made the All-Star team when he was 24. The common assumption at the time was that he was bound for the Hall of Fame. But by age 30, set back by injuries and an ill-advised stint with the Yakult Swallows of the Japanese League, he was out of professional baseball entirely. On the other hand, the Seattle Mariner great Edgar Martinez did not have a steady job in the big leagues until he was 27. He was a late bloomer, however, having his best years in his late 30s and leading the league in RBIs when he was 40. Although Horner and Martinez may be exceptional cases, it is quite rare for players to follow the smooth patterns of development that the aging curve implies. Instead, a sort of punctuated equilibrium of jagged peaks and valleys is the norm. Real aging curves are noisy. Very noisy. On average, they form a smooth-looking pattern. But the average, like the family with 1.7 children, is just a statistical abstraction. Perhaps, Gary Huckabee reasoned, there was some signal in the noise that James's curve did not address. Perhaps players at physically demanding positions like shortstop tended to see their skills decline sooner than those who played right field. Perhaps players who are more athletic all around can be expected to have longer careers than those who have just one or two strong skills. Huckabee's system hypothesized that there are 26 distinct aging curves, each applying to a different type of player. If Huckabee was correct, you could assess which curve was appropriate to which player and could therefore predict how that player's career would track. If a player was on the Bob Horner track, he might have an early peak and an early decline. Or if he was more like Martinez, his best seasons might come later on. While Huckabee's Vladimir nailed some of its predictions, it ultimately was not much more accurate than the slow and steady type of projections developed by James that applied the same aging curve to every player. Some of the issue was that 26 was an arbitrary number for Huckabee's categories, and it required as much art as science to figure out which group a player belonged in. However, a person must have a diverse array of physical and mental skills to play baseball at an elite level. Muscle memory, physical strength, hand-eye coordination, bat speed, pitch recognition, and the willpower to stay focused when his team endures a slump. Vladimir's notion of different aging curves seemed like a more natural fit for the complexities inherent in human performance. In developing Pacoda, I tried to borrow some elements from Huckabee and some from Bill James. In the 1986 Baseball Abstract, James introduced something called similarity scores, which, as their name implies, are designed to assess the statistical similarity between the career statistics of any two major league players. The concept is relatively simple. They start out by assigning a score of 1,000 points between a set of two players, and then deduct points for each difference between them. Highly similar players might maintain scores as high as 950 or even 975, but the discrepancies quickly add up. The similarity scores are extremely satisfying for anybody with a working knowledge of baseball history. Rather than look at a player's statistics in a vacuum, they provide some sense of historical context. Pedroia's statistics through age 25, for instance, were similar to those of Rod Carew, the Panamanian great who led the Minnesota Twins in the 1970s, or to Charlie Gehringer, a Depression-era star for the Tigers. James mainly intended for his similarity scores to be backward-looking, to analyze, for instance, how suitable a player's statistics were for the Hall of Fame. If you were trying to make the case that your favorite player belonged in Cooperstown, you had observed that 9 of the 10 players with the most similar statistics had made it there, you'd have a very strong argument. But couldn't similarity scores be predictive, too? If we could identify, say, the 100 players who are most comparable to Pedroia through a given age, might not the performance of those players over the balance of their careers tell us something about how Pedroia was likely to develop? This was the idea that I set out to work on. And slowly, over the course of those long days at KPMG in 2002, Pacoda began to develop. It took the form of a giant, colorful Excel spreadsheet. Fortuitously so, since Excel was one of the main tools that I used in my day job at KPMG. Every time one of my bosses walked by, they assumed I was diligently working on a highly elaborate model for one of our clients. Eventually, by stealing an hour or two at a time during slow periods during the workday, and a few more while at home at night, I developed a database consisting of more than 10,000 player seasons. Every major league season since World War II was waged, as well as an algorithm to compare any one player with another. The algorithm was somewhat more elaborate than James's and sought to take full advantage of baseball's exceptionally rich data set. It used a different method for comparing a set of players, what is technically known as a nearest neighbor analysis. It also considered a wider variety of factors, including things like a player's height and weight that are traditionally more in the domain of scouting. Like Huckabee's system, Pacoda provided for the possibility that different types of players might age in different ways. But it didn't try to force them onto one of 26 development curves. Instead, it let this occur naturally by identifying a set of comparable players somewhere in baseball's statistical galaxy. If it turned out, for instance, that a disproportionate number of Dustin Pedroia's comparable players turned into strong major leaguers, that might imply something about Pedroia's chances for success. More often, however, a player's most comparable players will be a mixed bag. The paths of players who might have similar statistics through a given point in their careers can diverge wildly thereafter. I mentioned that under James's similarity scores, Pedroia was found to be similar to Charlie Gerringer and Rod Carew, two players who had long and illustrious careers and who eventually made the Hall of Fame.